to people. What were you when Pete Flaherty was mayor?
Pete Flaherty was mayor, I was the chief inspector of police. I liked Pete, I'd known Pete for many, many years. As a matter of fact, Pete and I and my partner met when he first came to District Attorney Boyle's office. That was about 1956, 57. 57, I guess he came. Mm-hmm. He was an assistant ADA, as they called him, assistant district attorney. And Pete was rather hardworking, but he liked my partner and I because when we came in with a case, it was ironclad. Mm-hmm. We had all the things that he needed, all the pluses and minuses to get a conviction. And of course, I guess an assistant district attorney getting a conviction was important because he certainly went further than just being an ADA. Mm-hmm. But, I didn't care for some of Pete's politics. I told him that, and of course, as a result, I would never be promoted. I knew that. But nevertheless, I always felt that I had to be true to myself.
What politics of his didn't you like, and why wouldn't he promote you?
Well, you know, I think he agreed that I'd stay an assistant, or the chief inspector. I think one of the, and these were just personal politics.
Yeah.
It may have nothing to do with the way he did it, but maybe the people that worked around him had that were responsible for hiring people that were defenseless, or firing, rather, people that were defenseless to work in the city county building and needed the jobs the most. And the money that was saved was just infinitesimal. It was nothing. So as a result, it was tough because these people usually got fired right around, you know, Christmas time. I just go to the holidays and I in December, and I thought this was wrong. But nevertheless, why he didn't stop it, I don't know if he promoted it, but nevertheless, he was still the mayor, and I guess he has to bear the
No, I'm aware of many chicken shit behaviors of his, and you just gave me an example of it.
Exactly.
Why did he do it?
Well, I think one thing Pete always wanted to prove to somebody, and of course I got this from Kenny Ross and other people, he was nobody's boy. Now, Kenny Ross and four or five other business people locally collected about $50,000 for Pete's campaign. And of course, they thought at least they'd have an entree to say hi, Pete. They didn't want anything. I don't think that Pete could have provided them anything because most of them, their businesses were outside the city anyhow. But they found out very quickly, once Pete became mayor, he wouldn't even give them an audience. And this bothered them tremendously because they figured, hell, if they're going to contribute to a man's political campaign, which is helping his career, at least they ought to be able to say, hi, Mayor.
At least courtesy.
Absolutely. There's, yeah. You know, this is something I could never understand, but again, this was Pete. And I think what happened to Pete is I think Pete became a little paranoid after he became mayor of the city of Pittsburgh. I think he became frightened of people. I think he let other people do the things. He had some good ideas, and then he'd give them to his appointed officials and have them carry them out. And if they worked, he'd take credit. If they didn't, why, they just ignored it. But in any event, I think a lot of mayors have that problem. Dick Caligiuri was the same way. I think he became paranoid after he became mayor. I guess he realized what power he had or what power he may have lacked. Maybe he thought he had more power than he did, but I think he let too many people who were his assistants make decisions for him as mayor. Now, it's okay to advise me if I'm an elected official, but hell, I elected the mayor of the city of Pittsburgh, not the people he appoints. And I think what happens, and this happens at the state and federal level, is the appointed officials suddenly, after a period of time, get a tremendous amount of clout, and you start dealing directly through the appointed officials and not the elected official, because they want to escape the bad news and some of the responsibility.
Well, in Pete's case, to stay with him for a moment, he had this peculiar feeling about the upper crust and the corporations.
Well, he thought that he could run a major city without ever, you know, without ever sitting down and discussing with the industrialists as Dave Lawrence did. I think Pete looked at Dave Lawrence and thought, well, he was bought and paid for. That was not the truth. No large city can ever move forward unless you talk to the big money people in that city, because they're spending money, they have the employees, they have the investment. They're the ones responsible for the operation of that business. And if they don't think they can get anything back from the city, then they're certainly not going to cooperate. In other words, they want to stay in the city, but and they don't want necessarily want recognition, but they must have some understanding of what direction the city's going to take so that their business doesn't fold on them. And I think that was a problem. I think when the city got weak, I think a lot of these businesses, you know, moved out, laid off employees, there was just nothing more. The economy got weak, the city got weak, and of course, last but not least, some of the employees were laid off. Bell Telephone's a case in point right now. I think they're negotiating. I don't know, 500 lose their job or something like that. I didn't know that you needed 500 operators for
Cuba.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but they say, you know, I don't believe what they say, but they're free to say.
They must be one part of it. I wouldn't imagine the 85. But anyway, Pete had this peculiar aversion, it seems, to a certain class of people who were helping the city. He ran them out.
Well, I don't know if he ran them out, but he alienated.
He alienated them. And
I think they stayed away from him. They may not have left, but they just didn't get close to him. But I think, you know, and I blame Gene Kuhn, and Gene Kuhn was my partner. In 1973, when Dick Caligiuri ran against Flaherty, I think he only lost by 10,000 votes. And to be quite honest with you, I think if Gene had gotten off his butt and gone out and did a little campaigning for Caligiuri, because he was then he was the Democratic chairman of Allegheny County and the city of Pittsburgh. I think Caligiuri would have made it then. I think Pete would have been dead in the water right then and there. Mm-hmm. Because the 10,000 votes is, you know, that just proves that somebody didn't do their homework.
Didn't do that.
And I think that maybe there was a sweetheart deal between Gene and
Flaherty.
It could have happened. I don't know.
I really don't.
Yeah. But it's a shame, and Gene and I, we never discussed it.
My own feeling, which I'm not supposed to put in here, is that if any politician broke this city, it was Flaherty.
Mm. There's no question about it. They kept cutting back and cutting back and cutting back. One of the things that bothered me the most is we can do more with less. You can never do more with less.
And that was his slogan.
I understand, but you can't do more with less.
Yeah.
Because people aren't going to work harder and receive less money for it. It's just impossible. It's ridiculous. But nevertheless, this is Pete and repeat and the whole darn thing. And
well, then
Pete was thinking of running for mayor this time, and I don't think he stood a chance. I don't think I think Murphy was going to walk in no matter what, because after the last election, there was no question. And Sophie and I discussed it many times that, you know, we both felt that the next mayor, if she didn't run again, or if she did, even after the next time, would be Murphy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I got my own. I'm kind of bitter about Pete.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Let's talk a little bit about Caligiuri. You know, a guy dies and he's sainted.
Well, but that's bullshit. And let me explain something. I knew Dick Caligiuri. We went to school together. We graduated together, all that. And the Caligiuri family knew the DeRoy family, the DeRoy family, the Caligiuri family. And, you know, and through the years, Dick was a hard worker. And I think he sincerely wanted to be mayor. He loved this city. And I think I love it too. But I like it from an appointed position, not from an elected position. So I'd rather be the chief of police than the mayor of the city. But that's neither here nor there. I think one of the problems toward the end was, you know, Dick didn't have a college education, and this bothered him tremendously. And he had some people around him. They convinced him that he was so damn stupid that they had to make all the decisions. Well, this is a fact. And they had to make all the decisions, and he could go ahead and cut ribbons and do all the ceremonial things. And Dick loves ceremonial things. And Dick was a kind person. He liked that. And he loved the people. But he hated to make the hard decisions that required, and it didn't require intellect, it just required common sense. And sometimes when you're talking about people that have had college educations, they've gone to college to the point that they've sworn to give up common sense so they can get their master's or their doctorate. You know, and then when they come out, they have no common sense from that point on. And they make a very simple thing very difficult. And the reason they do this is nobody can understand what the hell they're doing. And they can guard this because it's their idea, when it's really very simple. But anyhow, Dick Caligiuri, I think he would have been mayor as long as he wanted to be mayor, except Dan Lugosi stepped in. Unfortunately, he didn't want the public safety department reinstated in 1985. But by 1985, he knew he was sick. I knew he was sick. I didn't know what the hell he had, but he had something. As I talked to him on his porch on Beecher Boulevard, you know, we were friendly enough, and Jeannie, his wife, and David and Greg, the two sons. And it was very interesting, but I knew that he was doctoring, and he had been doctoring, and they hadn't yet really diagnosed it as amyloidosis because they didn't really know what it was. He was in the stage right before you go into amyloidosis that they can really identify. Yeah. Many times you have a disease, it's too premature to diagnose. But after that, then they started to work on him with his public safety department. Pete Flaherty was wise in one respect. He realized it was probably one of the most useless departments in the world, public safety, because you had the chief of police, you had the fire chief, you had the paramedic chief reporting to a director who reported to him. If I'm the mayor of the city of Pittsburgh, you're the chief of police, you're the fire chief, and you're the paramedic chief, I want to hear it from you.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't want it watered down and spoon-fed to me by this guy in the middle who's going to do it. And I get up there and make an ass out of myself because I didn't really have the meat of the problem.
Yeah.
I think that Tom Murphy's going to do that. We don't need, other cities where they've had public safety directors, they've eliminated them too. They tried it in one city for 3 years and they dropped it because the mayor said, all of a sudden there's another layer of bureaucracy.
For nothing.
Right, and I'm too far removed from the truth. And he used the right word, he's too far removed from the truth because this son of a bitch, he's going to spoon feed him to keep his job. He goes, yeah, everything's fine. Now it's just a little problem here, a little problem there. And the mayor said, hell, I turned around. It was a big problem. It wasn't a little problem. Then he got it straight, and that's the end of that. So Dick Caligiuri, I was a friend of mine, and I think he's a good mayor. He was a good mayor. Toward the end, he was too sick to make many of his decisions. And as a result, he turned his whole administration over to his appointed officials, who I don't think did him justice.
Didn't do him justice.
How do you spell Caligiuri?
C-A-L-I-G-U-I-R-I.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sophie made you boss,
right.
So I don't suppose I should ask you for critical remarks, but make a couple of remarks.
Well, Sophie's been a friend of mine for years, and it wasn't just through friendship. Sophie had watched me for years, and I knew her brother, Mo Nyberg. And I was there what was it, 12th or 13th or 14th of January, about December of 1955, when he came home one night and told his wife, I'm going to lay down in the living room, call me for dinner. And the kids were upstairs. He laid down. He was a cycle man. The cycle was out in the garden. And he laid down, and of course, he never got up again. He had a massive heart attack, and of course, he died right then and there. I was in the homicide car with a friend of mine by the name of Marty Corcoran. And when that address came in, it was broadcast. At that time, we provided all ambulance service in the city. The police did. We didn't have paramedics.
Mm-hmm.
Consequently, when we arrived on the scene, we went in, and there was Mo. He was Morris Nyberg, his name. He was absolutely white. He was dead. Mm-hmm. Wasn't anything to be done for him. So the ambulance came, and they took him to the hospital, which time the coroner picked him up and took him down. But nevertheless, Wayne was pronounced dead. And I remember talking to Sophie that night, and she worked in the courts at that time. And she was a lot younger, as was I, 55 to 95, God, that's a long time. But in any event, why, it's 48 years.
40 years.
55, 75, 65, 75, 85, 90, yeah, it would be 38 years. But in any event, why, through the years I ran across Sophie, and she ran for council, and I supported her for that. And she was a very sincere, loving, and caring individual. And matter of fact, one night we were out, and my wife and I, we were eating, and I was sitting next to Sophie, and she was the boss. And I was just an assistant chief. And she said, you know that's your salad fork. You don't eat with your salad fork. That's for the salad. In other words, and I busted out laughing, and of course Debbie heard this too. I'm laughing because that's exactly what my mother would have said, and I always used a salad fork for everything, unless my mother was there. And Sophie was just, you know, she was just a person that, that liked, you know, that liked people. And
well, was she the mayor we needed now?
Well, I don't know what mayor you need now, because any mayor you got now and you might need now isn't going to be able to do nothing now, because legislature isn't giving us the authority to tax. The only way the city can raise money is on property owners. And that's a disgrace, because the property taxes are going too high. But there must be other ways to tax, and you're going to have to get suburbanites involved. The nucleus of Allegheny County is the city of Pittsburgh. Everything emanates from it. Everything is drawn toward it. For your great race, for your regatta, for the 4th of July celebration, all of this, that costs money. And I told Debbie the other night when they were interviewing people on television, I said, watch how many of these people are from the city. I said, 4 out of 5. Definitely, 80% of the people that went to that fireworks display were not city residents. Exactly. And they're not paying a God bless it nickel. And consequently, if you want to have fun in the city, you're going to have to pay for it. Plus, we have another problem in Pittsburgh. We have 55 square miles. And out of the 55 square miles, 45% of that is tax-free. That's the churches, the synagogues, the schools.
Hospital.
Your hospitals, particularly your in Oakland, there's a tremendous amount of it. And the hospitals are expanding more every day. Not that we don't need the health services, but it's just the idea. The more they expand, the less the city has on the payroll. You take Allegheny Cemetery out there, you know, next to St. Francis Hospital. If that was filled with homes, do you realize how much that would bring into the city? But again, we got a cemetery, and they take a tremendous. Of course, when Allegheny Cemetery was started, it was outside the city limits because Pittsburgh didn't extend out that far. But the problem is, it's a matter of taxes, and people are only deluding themselves when they think that they can run a city. It's like running a business. If you don't have the sales and you're not making the money, you can't continue in business. And the cities are going to find that out. But then there's another thing, and of course, I guess Reagan was right. He says, hey, wait a second. If you people need the money, raise the taxes in the city. Don't make us raise the taxes of everybody. It comes to Washington, and then we send it back to you, and we're the bastards, and you're the good guys, because you never raise taxes, and we have to keep raising their income taxes. I said, in other words, he felt it was just an oblique move like this, and he's absolutely right.
Of course, the feds took part of it.
Oh, well, sure they did. There's no question about it. But the problem is they were giving a whole hell of a lot back, and they knew how much they needed. So if they were giving so much back, they had to keep raising it so that they gave what they thought was necessary back again. So Reagan wasn't wrong in that respect. You know, they call it trickle-down economy or whatever the hell it was. That doesn't necessarily work either, because the way companies are run today, it isn't like the old benevolent companies, years ago, where they gave something back to the community, like Carnegie, Illinois, J&L, all of these others. They were community-oriented. These guys like that guy, what's that guy in jail, stock the junk bonds and all that?
Any of them.
Well, the one fellow in New York, you know, that he was buying companies right and left, but to put them out of business. And then, you know, and then he had the stock, and then however the hell they worked it, I mean, that was the way you made money. So you came into Pittsburgh, you buy 2 or 3 companies, and you put them out of business. Now all those people are out of business. Now nobody's paying any. But I mean, that was what they
did. Yeah, well, nevertheless, Sophie tried to be mayor, and we're going to have Murphy next.
Well, Murphy's going to have the same problems that Sophie did. He can see that on the horizon. There's no question about it. He's not going to be in the super mayor. He's going to try like hell. But the problem is, see, he's a legislator today, so we're buddies, you understand? Mm-hmm. Now I'm the mayor, and you're still a legislator. It's going to be a whole new ballgame when I come to Harrisburg to ask you for money for my city. Just because I was one of you doesn't mean that you're going to say, hey, we're going to give you the money, because it's not going to work that way. He already knows that. There has to be some kind of a unique tax structure that allows the cities to tax 1 or 2% on something and get some of that money back, because they certainly need it.
Certainly, absolutely. You mentioned that the police force provided guard and protection for various visitors. Why don't you mention a few visitors and that you might have run into and any stories about them?
Well, the police force provides protection to the Secret Service every time a president or a vice president visits the city of Pittsburgh. And we started, way back, and I was with Slusser all the way back when Eisenhower and all the rest would come through or have some meeting, or Mamie Eisenhower would come, and we always made sure there was protection. In any event, I think one of the most impressive people that I can recall John Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And John Kennedy came here in 1963 before he went to Dallas, and he was pushing the election for a fellow by the name of Clark, who was then a senator.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, Schweiker took it. Mm-hmm. The Republican took over, so mm-hmm. it didn't help out. But nevertheless, he was. We went that day. We had a tremendous route. We went from Pittsburgh to Little Washington, to Apollo, to the Manassas, to Grant, Vandergrift. We then went up to Greensburg. We made a complete circuitous route and back to Pittsburgh, and we were out there for 16 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we were fed, and and Kennedy made some beautiful speeches. And he was an interesting person. He certainly liked nuns. That was one thing he liked. Every time he saw a group of nuns, the cavalcade had to, caravan had to stop so we could have see the nuns. LBJ was the most interesting. He was the most profane guy. And we're standing here in the Civic Arena, and Genevieve Ladd, who just died the other day, she's giving a speech in preparation to introduce Lyndon Johnson. And I'm standing next to Lyndon Johnson, and he turns to me and he said, "Officer," he said, "where's the men's room?" I said, "Mr. President, right there to your right. Or to your left," and I said, "General." He says, "I got to take a leak." I says, "I can imagine you've been busy all day." He says, "As soon as I go and I put my hand on that door, that broad out there doing all that talking, she's going to introduce me, and I'm not going to be able to take a leak." I said, "Then you're going to have to give a very short speech." He says, "Well, I like that part of it, but I still got to pee." I says, "Well, use stronger language." I said, "Just go through that door." He says, "I'm going to try it. Do you think it's worth it?" I says, "No, but I'd try it anyhow." He no sooner hand hit the door and says, "Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's my distinct pleasure." He said, "Well, bitch." I busted out laughing. He said, "It's not as funny as you think it is." I said, "I wouldn't want to be in your..." I'll never forget Secret Service. They were hollering, I thought the greatest guys to work with as the vice president was Spiro Agnew. He was probably one of the nicest of presidents or vice presidents we ever met. Of course, Hubert Humphrey was too. Hubert Humphrey knew me well. "You keep that goddamn caravan under 70, D-Roy, because you keep going up around." I says, "Mr." And as a matter of fact, I didn't tell him. You know, the Secret Service wanted it 80 miles an hour because we were running late and the plane wasn't going to wait for him. We got out to the airport, and I had led the caravan out there. He got out of Joe Barr's limousine. He came running up. He says, "God damn it, they were in. I told you, when I go 80 miles an hour, I want to be in the air." I said, "Yes, Mr. Vice President," and so on and so forth. I just let it pass and so on and so forth. "Damn it, nobody listens to me. I'm the vice president." "When I'm the president?" I said, "Well, I wish you well, vice president." He walked away, and he says, before he left, he says, "I couldn't even have a conversation with your mayor." And I knew he couldn't have a conversation with my mayor, because when I walked back to the car, I knew what he was going to find. Joe Barr was laying on the floor with a bottle of booze, and he was out of it. So you couldn't talk to him. And believe me, Joe, I have the greatest respect for Joe Barr. I he too liked the city of Pittsburgh, and he tried, as did Sophie and all of them. It's just that their hands are so tied, economically today, that they can't be super mayors anymore. It's just impossible. It's just another job. Mm-hmm. Her job was no different than mine or anyone else that worked for the city. She came to work, and they had ideas, and she had Joe Mystic was her assistant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. executive assistant. He had her step forward with that goofy baseball stadium, never once telling her, but Sophie, say it's 8 or 10 years down the road, it's not now. Because at the time she made the announcement, they're laying off city employees.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, gee, gods, you know. And never once did Joe, I'm very upset with him to this day, did he take responsibility for pushing her forward.
Yeah, but wait a minute, she should know they didn't have money. I knew it, everybody knew
it. I understand that, but that isn't the point. See, what happens is the mayor's mind gets so clouded.
So ridiculous.
Well, it gets so clouded with the things that you'd like to do and your visions and everything else that when you get out there and you talk to people, you know, you forget about time. And she should have said, of course, this is in the future. She forgot to say that. Of course, she got something backwards one day when we said, I said, this is a war on crime. And, you know, this is a war on drugs. And she got up there and she got it backwards. She said, this is a drug war. And I said, oh, Jesus. Now I know we're in trouble, you know. And I had to straighten this out with the media, and eventually we did, you know. But it was just one of those things that was just amazing.
I know Barr had a reputation for drinking, but did it affect his work?
Not really.
No.
Because, you know, so many of these mayors had their executive secretaries doing all the work for them, you know, doing the paperwork and this, that, and the other thing. And I guess some days, it, you know, you're busier than others. However, Barr was never loaded when he went to any meeting. Just one of these. If you had to spend any time with Hubert Humphrey, you'd have started to drink. But this guy was absolutely something else. He was a nice guy, you know. And Hubert was well-meaning and all, but he was just a human buzzsaw. And after Jim Barr was not that kind of, he was not that kind of a person. You know, he was kind of laid back. And Humphrey's going buzz this and buzz that and everything
else. Yeah, he'd make him nervous.
Yeah, well, he made him uncomfortable.
Remember, he was not a bosom buddy of Hubert. He didn't see Hubert.
He was with Hubert when they had that the police and the hippie confrontation in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
So he was close to Hubert. But sometimes you're close to people in politics, but I want to be close to you, but about like an arm's length.
Yeah. Well, that's different.
Yeah. But I think. I think Hubert was good. Of course, Clinton, he was a candidate that was in here, and everybody said, well, you know, there's no doubt that Bush is going to make it. I said, I don't know. You know, we don't discuss politics, you know, especially around the public where they can hear you, because they figured, hey, these guys are police. They have the inside track. They hear conversation that nobody else, you know, can hear. And I've heard many, many conversations between the president and somebody else, but it's just not something I'd reveal.
Yeah.
And for some reason or other, when you're dealing at that level, you can get that out of your mind real quickly, so you can't even remember you heard anything like that, because you just don't want to be quoted. I found Nixon to be a very nice person. There was no question about it. I remember when Nixon came in 1960, he was running against Kennedy. He came to the Carlton House. I'm standing there, and I'm looking around, and there's no city politicians at all, not even from the Republicans. So we were his detail. You know, there were three of us. We were going to be a security detail because he was running, so on and so forth. And I looked around, and I said, well, I said, you know, I said, he's vice president. I said, Mr. Vice President, I said, I guess I'm your official reception committee. Welcome to the city of Pittsburgh. I said, we're going to be with you all day. I said, but I don't think I'm checked for lunch. Oh, I'll take care of that. I see the house. Oh, Jimmy Carter. I have pictures, a lot of pictures with presidents, you know, Rick and Simon, George Bush, and the rest. But these are just nice, you know, if you look back.
Did you ever see Rickover? Admiral Rickover?
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did Bettis submarines for the Navy.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
The first nuclear submarine.
Yeah. Did you, how about some of the corporate chiefs?
The corporation people?
Corporation people.
Oh, we ran across them quite often.
Like who?
Oh, hell, now I got to remember names. Well, one of the biggest ones was Willard Price at Westinghouse. Mm-hmm. Going way back here, his son became a judge, and later on a superior court. He, as a matter of fact, he married them in 1940 club.
Mm-hmm.
And Will Price was a good friend. Will was a nice guy. I liked him.
He might have been a nice guy. Was he a good guy for Westinghouse? You wouldn't know that.
Well, Westinghouse wasn't suffering during his tenure, so I guess
no.
It was. But see, the idea was things ran smoothly in those days. And again, leverage buyouts and all these other problems that they have today, they didn't have people trying from Japan coming in or other countries with good products, but at a far lower price and forcing them right out of business. That's what happened. And General Motors, if they hadn't thought to start closing some of these plants, they were overproducing. We've been overproducing for years. And when they said years ago, and it was always a theme, what's good for General Motors is good for America. It, bullshit it was. The Corvair wasn't good for anybody. You know, and so many times when the Corvair first came out, I went to so many of those front-end accidents where they hit head-on. Every time the Corvair would blow up. You know, because the gas tank was sitting right over the with the driver. I couldn't understand how they could build a car like that. They did with the Model T Ford, but that was a different era. That was entirely different. That was gravity. You know, but you saw those things and some of the mistakes that they made for years. We could see these accidents, and it was a direct result of ineptitude plus cost. It took
they put the engine in the rear.
Right? Well, they put the engine in the rear, then they forgot to put the support on the wheels, and when they went around a curve, the wheel would buckle under, and I can't tell you how many Corvairs I saw on their side like that going around a clover leaf. They'd just roll right over and stop. Because they wouldn't put the buck and a quarter piece of, shim or whatever the hell it was, tie rod, extra tie rod there. They wouldn't get it. They said it's too expensive.
Yeah.
Too expensive.
Did you have any experience with the Russians